was originally what I was planning to show is some data we've been collecting with a new instrument Kale Fallgater and I have developed, Kale's over there. But then, of course, last weekend arrived, and I thought it might be kind of fun to show some pictures from our new instrument of what fell last weekend on the roof of the William Browning building. And Christy Wall helped out there by providing some radar imagery to go along with it. But I think, you know, I mean, when we as atmospheric scientists think of snow, we probably have a pretty sophisticated idea of what snow flakes and snow crystals actually look like. But this, of course, is not the general view that's
Utah snow triumphs. Listen up, people. Boats, Driggs, Harrison, Rollins. You're going to Utah. The rest of you guys, seriously.
Come ski the greatest snow on earth just 30 minutes from the Salt Lake International Airport. Plan your ski vacation at Utah.travel.
I mean, of course, you know, snowflakes aren't these gorgeous things that, you know, we might see here, but this is, you know, this is a sort of picture that has captured the imagination for a long time, where people like Wilson Bentley, who was a farmer in Vermont and sort of an amateur scientist, came up with these gorgeous pictures using photographic techniques he developed that displayed this sort of perfection that really captures the imagination. I mean, there's a gorgeous simplicity and complexity at the same time that is going on here, and of course, people like to think of this being like people, with, you know, each beautiful and individual in its own way, no two alike. And indeed, these are genuinely lovely pictures. And this is carried on to the present with the work by Ken Lebrecht, who is going to actually visit our department soon. And he's taken the whole business of snowflake photography to an entirely new level. These are real snowflakes, and he's captured them on a slide with a photographic system he developed, and with a mixture of lighting and better cameras than, of course, Wilson Bentley had. Yeah, he captures these gorgeous pictures. Ken Lebrecht's interesting. He's a professor, chairman of physics at Caltech, and his background is actually in solar physics, and he's, you know, of course, quite well known for that. And he's done this research into snowflakes entirely without any external support. I actually met with him at Caltech a while ago, and he said that it's impossible to get any funding to look at things like snow crystal growth within the physics community, where it's far more popular to do things like string theory, which of course is much more important applications than anything we might pursue. But nonetheless, he's managed to sell books with these sorts of lovely photos he's collected, and paid for his daughter's education, as he told me, through the sales of these books. Now, you know, these are gorgeous snowflakes, but as he himself will admit, they don't show up very often. There's about one every 10,000 might look like this. And even more close to home, there is work by Ed LaChapelle, who is a bit of an icon in ALTUS history. He went on to be a professor at the University of Washington in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences. I'm not sure I ever met him. Maybe Jim did, but I remember seeing his photo on the wall there. And he studied the relationship between snowflake form and the propensity for avalanches at ALTA. But he himself tried this a hand at the lucrative business of selling books with snowflakes. Here's a field guide to snow crystals, and as you can see on the front of this, again, there's this beautiful complexity and simplicity that goes on with these snowflakes. And I think in some ways this is a bit of a lie, and perhaps everyone, these guys must have known it, but it's a convenient one in this case. A, pictures like this probably sell books better than the real thing, but also snowflakes like this are tremendously easy to photograph compared to the real thing. I mean, here you've got a nice snowflake that conveniently lies flat so that you can focus on it and get high detail. And it's not going to be hugely deformed in the process of settling onto microscope slide. And I think ideally, because we are not interested, as perhaps Ken Lebrecht might be, in the sort of crystal shape and how crystals actually grow through the basal or prism faces, which is a very difficult, complex problem, one that's largely been unsolved for decades despite a lot of effort. We are more interested in what is actually out there. And for that purpose, what we would ideally want to measure is the snowflakes as they are coming down in free fall, so that we would actually image them without actually having to touch them. And of course, we are also interested in things like how fast they fall, since this is a primary parameter that we would need to know for making weather forecasts. I mean, it's one thing to be able to simply apply the Clausius-Clapeyron equation and condense water vapor out of the atmosphere and make snow or water, condensed water in a cloud, but totally a different matter and a much more difficult problem to figure out how fast it falls and where it falls and in what sorts of shapes. Is it going to snow, drop, or rain, or whatever it is? And the instrument that has been available until recently, thanks to Kittle, is something called the 2D video distrometer, which is produced by a company in Joannian, called Joannian Research in Austria. And this is able to image hydrometeors in free fall without touching them and simultaneously measure their fall speed. And it does this from two different angles. It does it in 90 degree angles. In fact, there was a talk on this instrument just last Friday in our department. But I think as you can see here, there is a serious deficiency in this instrument. 200 microns resolution is not really adequate for getting all the details and complexities of crystals, which can be at very, very small scales. And furthermore, this is a silhouette. And honestly, I don't think one could truly assess whether or not this is a particle that's heavily rimed or simply one that is an aggregate of fluffy little snowflakes. Because as a silhouette, it could easily be either. So to address this problem, Kale has designed and built the multi-angle snowflake camera, or mask, which we have right here, and we'll do some demonstrations of this later. And the mask is able to image the particles from multiple angles, but it actually takes photographs. So we are actually able to see what the ice crystals look like. It's not their pictures aren't, as we'll show you, these aren't, won't be as, anything near as good as what Ken Lebrecht is able to do. Our particle is still moving very, very quickly at 1 meter per second. And that, of course, makes, and we don't know exactly where it is either. So we have depth of field and lighting issues. But what we have here is two 40-watt LEDs. Now, if you know anything about LEDs, 40 watt per LED is an insane amount of energy. In fact, if these were left on and you put your hand in here, I think, Kale, you said that it hurts very quickly.
It starts to sting.
Yeah, and that's the heat output by an LED. And the exposure time is 1/25,000th of a second, and that still introduces motion blur at that speed. And we have a set of IR sensors here that measure the snowflakes. We get tick, tick, that gives us a fall speed, and then three cameras inside give us multiple viewpoints of the snowflake. And this is the sort of thing we see. So this is one snowflake taken from three different angles, and then the fall speed is directly measured as being 0.97 meters per second. So I think, you know, by comparison to what Joannian Research is providing, this is something that's, you know, really quite different. Now, we do see a very, very wide range of snowflakes that we've been seeing at ELTA. I mean, everything is possible. I mean, this is just my overall impression, is that whatever is possible in nature is happening. We do see crystals of all sorts of different types. These are perhaps something as close to perfection as we might hope for. I guess I cropped off one of them right there. But, you know, some of them are still a little bit rhymed. There seems to always be some rhyming.
So how big are
they? Well, it depends. I didn't do a great job of rhyming them. But the smallest flakes we are able to image are 0.1 millimeters. And it just goes up to whatever size. So these would be, I think they would all be a fraction of a millimeter. And this one at the top, you see the cap column? That would be about 100 to 200 micrometers in size. So that would be a very small one. Or no, the cap column to the left, on the upper left, that would be about the smallest. And then we see even some Bulla Rosette assemblages on the top left, which surprised me because I would have associated those with cirrus normally. And then we see things like snow, which is, these are the big things. There are several millimeters across, up to a centimeter even. And yeah, it's just large clumps of snow that aggregates together, and we would call these aggregated particles. We see grauple in all sorts of different forms. I mean, it's all different. There's no like real simple message that comes out of this. They all almost seem to defy categorization in some ways. We see a fair number of these sort of space capsules that come out, but including, I like this image because you can see a water drop that's on there. I'm not really even sure how to explain that, because this water drop is, well, that must be like a raindrop even, because it's huge. I mean, this is about 5 millimeters right here. And then you look even on the surface of some of these, you see how it looks kind of dimpled in a lot of places. There's this dimpling on the surface of the grauple particles, which almost looks like it's impaction craters associated with the drops. You almost imagine them going splat and then freezing on the surface. And then we have this stuff, which, well, I don't know what category this falls into, but I mean, they almost defy categorization. And I think this is part of the message that I got so far, is that when it comes to categorizing snowflakes, the neat categories that are provided to us in textbooks they look good in textbooks, but the reality is that there's a full continuum of, I like to use the word complexity, and I came up with a complexity metric for how these snowflakes might be. So that things that are very complicated shapes have a high complexity metric.
So complexity and a continuum on what scale? I mean, do you know, in an event during, let's say, a particular period of time, do you have a wide scale, a broad continuum of types?
Yeah, so I, for this past weekend, I will show the timeline for complexity. The way I define complexity is it's the perimeter to the equivalent area circular perimeter. So the complexity would be unity for a droplet, and as you go to something that's more complicated in its shape, then the complexity goes up.
Because the storm vector, we would see populations of things come through the 2DP, or the PIP, basically, you know, the precipitation probe, that all look the same. And then it would change, and they would all look the same. You know, but they would all come through, you know, population of crystals with snowflakes would all come through and look the same. They would be at the same orientation, they would have the same number of arms, and then 10 minutes later they would be different, but they would, different than before, but they would all look the same.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's been my experience.
No, okay.
But, so we're looking at this problem, we're trying to figure out how these snowflakes evolve. I mean, what produces all these different types of snowflakes, and what are the mechanisms responsible for it? And with Sandra Uter at NC State, and working in collaboration with Howie, if you know Howie at Alta, he helps with a lot of the technical side of things, and with Kale, of course. We've set up a bunch of instrumentation along Collins Gulch. Some of it was already there. And we are trying to look at how snowflakes evolve as they fall sort of down the side of the mountain. I mean, we look perhaps directly up, or where some instruments are a bit off to the side, quite far off to the side, but we're doing the best we can do. We're using the mountain basically as a proxy of vertical height, looking at snowflakes evolve. And what we're hoping to do is perhaps take one of these horrible messes that is inside all weather models for describing how we progress at the top from water vapor through cloud water and cloud ice and snow and grauple and rain, and perhaps come up with, if not improved parameterizations for these complex processes that relate them. Look, that would be nice, but perhaps even be able to simplify them substantially, and I will show some results that suggest that may in fact be possible. I mean, each one of these arrows that's in there probably has, I don't know, it might be like 100 papers even associated with assessing how to appropriately do this, And this is a major weak point in the models in how well they are able to forecast storms. Perhaps partly because the instrumentation these parameterizations have been based upon hasn't been all that sophisticated. It's largely, I think, fair to say, 1970s technology. So for an example, we have a vertically pointing radar at Alta Base. And this is just one event I show for an example. And we have a mast right beside the radar. The radar is on the roof of Howie's house. The mast is outside Howie's house. And here you can see a clear transition from Crawpole, where the radar signal is very high. And as the day goes on and it becomes less convective, there we see a transition to aggregates. So this is a nice scenario which is roughly conforming with what we might expect. One thing I haven't looked at yet is comparing the data obtained higher up at Harold's cabin. So Harold's cabin was owned by Harold Goodrow, who used to live there up until I think the early 90s, and it was abandoned, and then we were able to take it over, I think, I want to say 2008, and use the basement as a lab. And we use the top deck as a lab. It's a complete bachelor pad inside. It's got like the plush carpet, a huge fireplace, this place that's recessed into the floor. And several occasions I've talked to women of a certain age in my neighborhood and asked them if they know of Harold Goodrow, and they get this wistful look in their eyes. Get many visitors, I guess. It's a great place. So we have an instrument up there that we use to look at the snowflakes, and then we can sort of make comparisons potentially between the snowflakes we see at Harold's cabin, higher up the mountain, and those at the base. Now, it's not the only place we've had the mast. Thanks to Kevin Hammonds. Kevin Hammonds took the mast to the summit of Greenland, and there it is there with a couple pictures taken of snowflakes taken at the summit, and the calibration tool he used to test whether or not the mask was actually working, shown down there. Any guess of what that is?
Yes.
Sponsorship.
And we, Kale and I have set up a company, so we are selling these instruments. If any of you want to buy one, we'll give you a good deal. We sold one to the Army, and they have one at Namik Ski Area where they are using it to do avalanche research. They have actually an incredibly nice setup there with a whole bunch of radiometric instrumentation. And so having this alongside it, I guess, helps. So, last week's storm. This is a timeline, so I can take the image data and the false speed data, and thanks to the glories of MATLAB and their teams of PhD mathematicians, they provide all sorts of tools that make analyzing images fairly straightforward. And here's a timeline from the 9th to the 12th, this is in local time, of fall speed, as you can see at the top. The size, this is the maximum dimension, so the largest dimension of the snowflake in any given direction. And the complexity of the shape, this is the complexity metric I mentioned, so it's, one would be a perfect sphere, and, two, anything above 1.5 I consider to be an aggregate. And then the aspect ratio, so the aspect ratio would be 1 for a square or a sphere, and as it departs more from unity, I mean it's arbitrary, whether it's height over width over height, but whatever it is, it's the aspect ratio you can see is changing over time. So you could imagine a Graupel particle will tend to have aspect ratios closer to unity than those, and then fluffy aggregates that are maybe spreading out into wraps.
Is this from the Browning Building or Alta?
Top of Browning Building.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is from Jim Steinberg's Wasatch Weather Weenies. It says UTC up there. I can't believe that. I think this has to be local time. I'm assuming it's local time.
No.
It doesn't match. Then it must be different there.
It's from Snowbird, and it's snowtail data, so there may be some irregularities.
Because if it's local time, it matches up. Oh, wait a sec. No, you're right. Is it? Well,
yeah, lake effect started around 7Z.
Okay. Well, I still probably have this right, where the front and the lake effect mashed up. That look right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yep.
And yeah, you look at this and you see, well, you have the size, you know, follows a nice little trajectory there. You know, got an arc to the frontal system, and then it gets more complicated with the lake effect. The complexity, well, that has a nice trajectory too during the frontal system. The aspect ratio seems to follow some inverted thing. But there's a fair bit of detail in there. So what I'm going to do is, I think Christy helped a little bit with this. We're going to pace through this and look at the pictures. So starting off at the beginning of the frontal system, you know, 7:12 a.m. local time is minus 0.5 degrees at 700 millibars. And we have relatively small crystals. If you look at the size, complexity is low, the aspect ratio is close to 1, and the particles are falling at close to 2 meters per second, and this is the sort of thing we see. We see, you know, conical grapple. Some of this stuff, I think, is intriguing, and this may even be the first time these sorts of things have ever been photographed, because this is... I imagine that this is melting ice. And... because it has a bit of this transparency to it. I mean, generally we get this reflection if it's true ice. And you can imagine this, you couldn't really photograph this sort of thing if it was landing on a surface, because if it's melted ice, it'll just splat. And the radar, of course, is a big radar signal. I don't know how to comment on radar. Maybe you can help me out here. So then we go into the middle of the event, the frontal system, and it's the size goes up, complexity goes up, aspect ratio goes down, frontal system's, well, still there, but it's not as strong as before, perhaps. And what sort of particles would you expect to see?
Aggregates.
So huge aggregates. You saw this outside. The scale is identical to what I had before. So you compare this to the grapple. Yeah, it's a big difference, isn't it? Yeah. And then we go on later, and then, well, I don't know what to call these things. I mean, these are just, it's plenty cold, minus 11.5 degrees, but this almost looks like it's melted stuff, but it can't be. So I'm not really even sure what these sorts of particles are. They're a little dim, but they're obviously smaller and more compact in shape.
Was there an inversion? Could they have melted higher up and fallen into a creek,
Jim?
Doubtful. There's probably a stable layer up there, but I don't think it would be inverted. But it's not out of the realm of possibility. It was a pretty shallow front that came through, so...
Yeah, and here's the radar signal. And the front's decaying.
Yeah, but that leak...
So then we go on to the lake effect portion of the storm. And there you see that the complexity of the shape just skyrockets. The fall speed is pretty low, but around 1 meter per second. Aspect ratio plummets. The size, pretty big, and we get these sorts of things. Really complicated aggregated shapes. And then moving on. Well, mine is still getting colder, minus 15.9, 700 millibars. This is in the morning of the 11th, Sunday. Still a lake effect, but huge grapple. I mean, these are immense grapple, and they almost look like snowballs, don't they? And then at the final part of the storm, I guess this would be a decaying lake effect, is that fair to say? Nodding your head, and back to fluffy aggregates. So there's certainly some transitions that are happening in here that, to me, aren't, it's not totally clear what exactly is going on. But nonetheless, we have a mixture of riming and aggregation. So I think if you don't mind, a lot of this is probably total review for most of you, but I think I'd like to give a little spiel on the sorts of microphysical processes that are actually happening in these storms, the sorts of things that we're trying to explain. And perhaps I'll start first with the Utah Tourism Board take on the problem.
Here I go! Woo!
Hey, dude.
Heading to Utah?
Oh, yeah, baby.
You know it.
Hey, slap me some flake. Whoa. No, don't get us off course.
I'm stuck to you.
You're stuck in my crystals. I don't like this very much.
No, this is what happened.
No, I don't like it. This sucks, dude. I hate this.
I love it.
I have to thank Tyler West for these point tours. All right, so the basic physics is, you know, of course, anytime we have snow, we have to start with a liquid cloud, and the basic idea is that we have a diffusional growth process, that water droplets, you know, straight from Walls and Hobbs, at least the old one, they have water droplets which diffuse preferentially towards ice because the vapor pressure over ice is lower than that over liquid. So the ice crystals grow at the expense of the water droplets, and they eventually fall. And certain ice crystal habits are preferred under certain temperature and humidity conditions. The sorts of crystals that the Utah Tourism Board likes to advertise are favored by high excess vapor pressures that might be associated with updrafts, but also relatively cold temperatures. So we have this regime right here where there's a maximum where we get this sort of dendritic growth that creates the classic snowflakes. Now, there was a wonderful study actually done here in our department by Nori Fukuda, who's a professor who passed away a few years ago here. He was one of a real legacy of people who could do things in the lab, and I mean, extraordinary things. And we have a super cooled cloud tunnel in the lab. I have no idea how to use it. It's just got all these huge knobs on it, and I can imagine him standing in front of it in his white lab coat. Something out of the old Japanese movies. Anyway, so this is the sort of thing he was able to do. He was able to create an updraft under controlled conditions and grow crystals through time. So you can see on the left is in early time, 5 minutes, and then it grows to 30 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes for certain temperature conditions, and you get the sorts of snowflakes that you would indeed expect. Now, this had all been done before, but what he was able to do was actually put a fog in there as well, so he could actually study riming processes. And the sort of model he created is one we might expect. These are pictures we took at Alta, of course, but we have start off with the vapor growth phase, diffusional growth, but then there's a transition to riming if there are sufficient droplets present. And so we start off with crystals at the top, we transition to riming growth, so you can still see the original form, but it's been impacted by droplets, and then it moves on to what we would call real rime particles. Now there's something really extraordinary about these particles, which is this particle might be 5 millimeters across. And it's a simple back-of-the-envelope calculation to determine that 10-micron droplets, the number of 10-micron droplets that are required to create a 5-millimeter droplet particle is on the order of 100 million. So, it's just a simple calculation. There's not any room for error, but this is 100 million. I mean, you're obviously looking at some sort of explosive runaway process that is taking over. And the ingredients here, I mean, it's a simple story. Crystal falls, it collects droplets, then its cross-section grows, and it falls faster. And this combination of a growing cross-section for collecting droplets and faster fall speed leads to a runaway growth process. And ultimately, the limitations to this are that the storm might be too shallow, so it runs out of cloud first, or perhaps there aren't enough droplets to begin with. Or maybe the Bergeron-Fedison process was particularly effective, so the droplets disappeared over time. And this was indeed reproduced in the lab. Here they have the initial stages of growth on the left side and then growing towards Grappo. And you see here that we have a transition that is dependent on how much water is present. So if you have a deep convective storm, might be 2.2 grams per meter cubed, a shallow storm, 0.1 grams per meter cubed. And the sorts of degrees of riming are apparent in how much liquid water is present in the cloud. It's fairly straightforward. And then the second thing is that as a particle grows, what he was able to measure was the fall velocity. And here's the growth time. So the growth time is a bit of a proxy for size. And the longer the growth time was, the larger the particle got, and the faster it fell. So you can imagine the fall velocity, well, that means that the crystals are growing particularly rapidly because they're collecting droplets particularly rapidly, but at the same time they run out of cloud more quickly. And the only way that this is going to be sustained for long enough is if the convective updraft is sufficiently high. So high convective updrafts, so a deep juicy storm with strong convection leads to droplet formation. And this can be expressed very simply mathematically. Simple diffusion growth, if we have hydrometer mass along the top and the depth of the storm along the y-axis, well, here the exponent is less than 1. So we have saturated growth. Eventually the mass saturates over time. But we have a runaway growth process in deep and juicy storms for Graupel and hail, so that the mass actually goes as the distance is followed to the cube, third power. Regardless, I mean, we've got a fairly complicated process here, and you can imagine that whatever goes into these models is going to be fairly complicated, and I'd like to quote Jim Steinberg here. When I asked him about this a while ago, he told me this, that, well, so that's not particularly surprising, but of course there's probably truth in it. We need convection or rapid uplift or warm storms to provide the water vapor and droplets to create lots of droplets. Now, what I'd like to show here, just conclude with, before Cale goes on to the demonstration part, is that a few results that suggest to me that maybe these microphysical packages in these models could actually be simplified a fair bit. One thing we are finding, and it was evident last weekend too, is that there is an extremely weak dependence of the fall speed of these particles on the size of the particles. So here's just like, it's a 2D PDF, so it's just a distribution function, I just drew a line through it. And you can see that the fall speed here is almost independent of size, it's about 1 meter per second, plus or minus, but it's about 1 meter per second. We saw the exact same thing at ALTA. If I compare it to shape, this is some sort of metric of the complexity, it's a metric of shape, we again see the exact same thing. There's no apparent dependence of the fall speed on shape, as is present in all the models. And one would expect that Graupel, because it is small and compact, would actually fall much faster than aggregates. And we don't see strong evidence that that is indeed the case. Now, there is perhaps a good reason for this that is well known in some of the engineering literature, but not in the atmospheric sciences community. And that is that if you map turbulence onto the terminal fall speed you would expect in a still environment, it changes the fall speed in such a way that fluffy snow aggregates swirl, as we all know, and this swirling actually means that the fall speed of the snow is faster than you would expect ordinarily. So that there is a convergence of fall speeds. Snow falls at roughly the same speed as Graupel, even though it is less compact. So there are some numbers you can look at, something called the Stokes parameter that looks at this. But this is something that seems to be a possible explanation for what we're seeing. Final thing, this I don't think is any relation to weather models, but one thing we are seeing in a few cases, and I'm not totally confident in this yet, whether this is not an instrument artifact or simply, or instead actually a really fascinating result, is that we see pictures of Graupel that seem to have fall streaks. So we have 1/25,000th of a second exposure time. And of course, you know, if there's motion blur, well, you can see a bit of the motion blur here in the picture. Can you all see that? We know the resolution of this picture. We know the exposure time. So we can calculate how fast, you know, what speed this corresponds to. But would you all agree with me that this looks like it's spinning? The motion blur looks like there's a rotational velocity to it. It's not just the one you would expect from it falling down. It looks like it's spinning. Well, you can calculate the speed of this spinning based on this motion blur, and it works out to be a tangential velocity of 1 meter per second. which is about the same as the fall speed. So it suggests that things are falling, and as perhaps the air is grabbing them and spinning them at the same rate. And if that's the case, then that would work out to 1,000 hertz as being the rotational speed of these grapple particles. Now, we know already that hail can rotate at about 20 hertz. The picture suggests that the grapple is rotating at something closer to 1,000 hertz, which is, pretty extraordinary. Or instead, what it could be is just that the grapple landed on the lights right here, acquired some torque, and tumbled into the field of view. this is always a problem with instruments. Maybe you've discovered something fascinating and new, or you've just discovered a problem with your instrument. So we actually built some tents to go on top of this to prevent that from happening, so it can't actually, it's got to bounce to the side now. And I'll be interested to see if we see more pictures like this in the coming season. So, thanks very much.
Tim?
Yeah?
You may want to comment that mask up at Harold's, in fact, being in a sheltered area, does show a difference in the velocity, so that those graphs that you showed were for an area that did not have a windscreen, essentially. So,
yeah, at Harold's we've got the cabin to act essentially as a windscreen, and there we do see mass relationships between fall speed and size. So this does suggest that indeed the turbulence is affecting the fall speed in some important way. It's not just some instrument artifact. I'm pretty sure it's not an instrument artifact.
So I suggest we ask 10 questions now on his contribution, and then we can continue. Is that okay? So
yeah.
If there are questions for Tim, please. Jimmy.
Yeah, this fall speed is actually quite important. It probably plays a huge role in the morphology of lake effect storms. So we're quite interested in the data you got this weekend. We've already been working on it and finding similar problems that we've had before. But I wanted to ask you about the those last couple graphs.
So there's your fall speed from the storm.
Right.
Didn't change. It was 1 meter per second the entire storm, despite all those transitions.
Yeah, but that's it does go up and down.
Yes,
and,
sure.
And you're sampling at a particular location. I was curious when you do the you had two fall speed graphs that you showed towards the end, and how you separated those two to make the conclusion that grapple has a similar fall speed to flakes. So that's on size.
So there you go. So let's say that this is actually last weekend's event.
Yeah.
It's a similar plot for an Alta base.
Yeah.
It's totally subjective, but if we're going to separate between grapple and snow, I'd do it right there.
Mm-hmm.
So grapple this way, snow this way.
Yeah, I think we ought to look at that, because I can't believe that big grapple has a fall speed of a meter per second. I mean, I've spent my whole life looking at snow.
Yeah,
I know it's not. I know it's a totally anecdotal impression, I do the 1,000, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 thing all the time with falling particles, and big grapple has a high fall speed.
Yeah, so we could separate it out by complexity.
Yeah,
and
I think that we should break that up, because it is really important. And then in the models, what they call grapple is not always grapple, what we would call grapple. And so, but this is really important. We'd love to dig into this if you're interested, because we've done some simulations. John's in here probably already chomping at the bit. And we think this is a critical component of some of the regular, we've done simulations of these storms, many of them, they all show the same kind of biases, and we think it is strongly related to some of the specification of fall speed in the microphysics. So
I think one main thing to do is to, because this was exposed on the roof, is to have some sort of timeline of a representation of turbulence. So let's say, gust minus winds. And I guess that's available on the roof, because then you could separate it out by the degree of turbulence.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call that turbulence, but we could play around with it.
Yeah,
we can also pull in the radar more. The KMTX is polar metric now. It might be helpful, although the beam is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be helpful for some of the analysis.
I looked at that a little bit when I was getting those radar images, and for me it was not very helpful. But I didn't zoom in very far, they looked at all of the other like dual pool. I was really surprised that I wasn't seeing anything that jumped out at me as interesting to show. But it didn't look that interesting.
I think putting a the wind speed, local wind speed up next to all these images and plots when you're looking at them would be important. From my experience of using the mask, and standing outside a lot of my time watching the snow, fall through the imaging area, if there's any kind of presence of a wind, the mask itself acts as a wind fence, and it can eddy particles down into that imaging area. And so I don't know how else you could account for that when you're trying to look at the plotted fall speeds other than also be able to look at the local wind at the same time.
Yeah, I agree that there's a big challenge here. And in fact, on the other side of it, where even people deliberately put up wind fences, there was a paper that came out recently, I think maybe you pointed it out to me, which pointed out that the wind fence itself selects for the types of particles that fall into the instrument. So,
how does that look like, the wind fence?
It would be like that.
Like a cylinder or something?
Yeah, something like that.
You could go to the engineering and let them run this through their wind tunnel. Mm-hmm. That would be a really great project for an undergrad to look at some of those issues. Mm-hmm. People have done that with precip gauges to explain undercatch and calculate efficiency as well and design better screens. So that would be something you could think about doing.
How long are those lights on? Are they flashing?
They flash, yeah.
So do they flash rapidly, or are they like
bang, 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 bang? 100 milliseconds, I think I have a set to.
So there's a lot of heat there. I mean, could you be creating some sort of convective current by heating the walls, the black walls?
Too short. I mean, it's...
You said if you put your hand in there, it gets...
No, but that's if they're left on.
If they're left on.
If they're left on.
Yeah.
So it's flashing.
It's flashing very slow.
Yeah.
I mean, the flash is so fast.
I mean, you'll see it.
Yes. I'm just. So how does the particle acquire a kilohertz of rotation?
That was the thing. So if you have a tangential velocity to the particle of 1 meter per second, I mean, I'm just imagining. I don't know what the fluid dynamics is, but let's say the particle surface is sufficiently roughened, it's falling through a fluid. Well, perhaps that fluid actually grabs that particle and rotates it as it falls down, because it's a similar velocity. But I'm not even sure that this isn't an artifact. But if it isn't an artifact, that's what I imagine must be happening. I mean, with the hail, certainly this is what they talk about, is that the interaction of the hailstone with the fluid leads to it rotating at a very fast speed, and that's what accounts for the forms of hail growth.
I can understand 20 hertz. You got the angular momentum conservation. I mean, you could actually, and there's constraints on that.
Well, what's 20 hertz? I mean, think hailstones are huge by comparison. So you 20 hertz, you take that rotational rate and or tangential velocity and apply it to a gravel particle, you may be actually getting to something that's similar.
Also, your 100 million number, I mean, droplets will expand when they freeze, right? So you kind of, by 10%.
It was back of the envelope.
But still, I mean, 10%, the density goes down to 0.9.
Well, so, okay. Now
what
is
that?
Again.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't.
There's also air in the air. I mean, you don't wind up with a 0.9, density droplet, or density droplet. It's like, what is it, 0.5? I think that...
It's still order of magnitude. It's...
So
10 million. I don't know. It's a big number. I mean, it depends on the grapple particle, of course. I mean, it's just up the size if you want a bigger number, or lower if you want a smaller one. The point is that there's a law.
Okay.
So what you showed a mixture of images from the storm this weekend that had some very, very small frozen droplets in it, it looked like, back at the beginning. And...
Well, there. There's one?
No, keep going back. Keep going. Back. Probably the first one.
Mm-hmm.
There it is. So, down on the bottom, third from the left. Okay? It looks like a sleep particle.
Right? Let me start which one. Yeah. This one right here.
And now I've seen these
And then do this. Is that number two?
Number two?
Just turn them off. This is like looking at the Mona Lisa. Well, let's not worry. But there are. I don't think those are grubs. They look like sleep particles, right? And how does sleep form? Supposedly it forms, right? Because snow falls into a layer that's above freezing.
Right there.
Snow falls into a layer that's above freezing. It melts. Then it falls into a deep layer and it refreezes. But I've seen these things. I mean, when you have these storms that are, you know, oftentimes close below, just below freezing, there are those things mixed in all the time. And how do they form? Are they forming by accretion on the their supercooled water? Just happens to be a few particles that accrete, get fairly large, and then find a way to freeze, so that they give the appearance of an ice pellet. But it's not really sleet, because I don't see how they can form based on just, you know, flake falling from the sky. In terms of how we tend to think about precipitation.
You don't think that could be a grotto that's just in the process of melting?
No, I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, was it below freezing at the surface?
I doubt it.
Yeah, it's usually close to freezing, but not quite.
I mean, it's minus 0.5 at 700
milliliters. Friday morning of this?
Yeah,
this
is what Friday morning.
Passage.
Yeah, Friday morning. I think it was pretty warm at this.
Yeah, I think it was pretty warm, too. I remember waking up to rain.
Yeah.
So
I think this was before it dropped below.
Before it dropped below. I'd be kind of curious to keep an eye out for those, because I do think it's really interesting. I always wondered. It usually doesn't dominate everything that's falling. They're just mixed in with a lot of other stuff, and I don't...
Well, this is... When I chose these particles, and this is from perhaps a 10 or 15-minute window on either side of 7:12 a.m. I just... 7:12... Christy chose 7:12 a.m., so I just followed her instructions.
It's interesting.
Set up somewhere back east.
Seriously, 10 minutes ago, or an hour ago, I was trying to code up aspect ratio relationships for radar for snowflakes. And Robin Hogan published a paper just recently that showed a PDF or statistics of the aspect ratio from C-130 runs through, you know, winter storms over the UK. They had a, you know, it ran right along 0.6, right along 0.6. So
that's similar to
exactly what you have there. Yeah,
that's interesting.
That's actually really cool.
So Kale has to leave soon. So it's still true.
It is still true.
So perhaps we could transition. You still got time? It's 4:20.
Yeah, got time. I mean, unless people would rather talk science.
No, this is way cool.
All right. I mean, you can still talk science because
does anyone know? I think he did some sort of etching thing where he collects them. I'm not really sure. You know, Nori Fukuda he actually developed some of the best techniques for doing this, where he found the optimum combination of solutions for preserving snowflake forms. So what he would do is he'd create a polystyrene solution in trichloroethylene, which is like for, you don't want to be around this stuff too long, but I think this is what the sort of thing they use for dry cleaning. And you just take polystyrene, you dissolve it in there, and you create a thin film of polystyrene, which is the exact combination solution. Toluene was another one that worked well. Create a thin film on the microscope slide, collect the snowflake on the microscope slide, and then what happens is that the snowflake evaporates and the solvent evaporates, and it leaves a perfect polystyrene imprint of the original snowflake that can be preserved for all eternity. And one of the big problems there was finding some sort of thing that preserved it well, but also evaporated sufficiently quickly that the snowflake wasn't evolving as the evaporation was going on. But I'm trying to do it myself, and it's, you take real snow, it's
I've never been successful. I can do it in the lab. And
so the idea is to take one initial tiny snowflake crystal and let it grow. That's kind of the idea. Yeah.
No, you just like fall onto the thing, and then it creates an imprint in the solution.
But usually,
and then the solution evaporates, and it leaves behind basically a polystyrene print of the snowflake. And
so
I've done this as with a student, undergraduate student, for an undergraduate project many years ago, and it was successful. You can use super glue too. That works. It's not quite as good, but it does.
I was thinking, can you produce snowflakes in a lab? You know, just one of like a little tiny.
Oh yeah, you can do it in the deep freezer. I mean, we do this in the class today. We do it all the time.
I don't know about it.
So it's trivial to do. You just need some bubble wrap and a cold enough freezer.
Or silver iodide.
Or silver iodide works well too.
Something that works.
But bubble wrap's the for home. The whole freezer for super cool droplets into ice crystals very rapidly. Or you can pump in silver iodide.
We should have them on for the next class session. Next class session. Okay. Just drag the freezer.
From the physical class.
If you have to.
We know what kind of we need to make that happen now.
Who is
seeing this
demonstration?
Excuse
me.
The deep freeze used to be like minus 27 or something down at the bottom that worked really well.
Yeah.
And then I was trying to get it like minus 22. Is there some threshold where it just doesn't work?
Sorry about the setup.
So Tim, what the heck is form bar? That we use.
Oh yeah, that was what they used to use, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Formaldehyde?
Yeah.
Well, DRI would fly replicators on aircraft. Like
they use form bars too?
Thousands of kilometers of tapes probably stored away in pallets, closets, replicator, just dried up ice crystals. But they, the ice crystals hit the thing at 100 meters per second, and it's just a disaster for the ice crystals.
If only we could do that with those ice crystals that they've gotten those Ski Utah ads.
Well, the first ones ever done that was at...
Who was the author of that paper? Like, we got this paper in German, and it was like the first time this was done was in a World War I German biplane, where they had this sort of replicator thing on it, and it was one of the first papers that has size distributions of ice crystals in it. And it's from like 1940 or something. And it was just this guy flying around in this, it was a real World War I biplane.
John Hallett.
Even older than that.
Tim?
Yeah.
Did you get a sense during the different periods in the storm last weekend where like it's obviously switched from gravel to aggregate, but was there a lot of size range in those subsets?
Yeah. There's always a huge size range.
So the winds
that's always the case. It's from, I'd say at least an order of magnitude, that probably been before.
Nothing surprising that would be different.
No, I mean, it's like what I mentioned. I mean, everything that's possible has happened.
It's happened.
Yeah.
Tim?
All right, so...
I'm going to run the computer. Go ahead.
Throw it over your shoulder.
Wow. Yeah, if you want the full effect, let's turn this off.
How you turn this off?
Three. So do you get comments from people up at Harold's cabin?
Not Harold's, but...
the first time we put it up, Howie got a complaint at 2 in the morning that the transformer was exploding. I guess he wasn't happy that he had to get off to go fix it. And then they have people... I mean, it was just... He was saying it's like just going off like the 4th of July. And eventually we had to lower the acquisition time interval of this. Mm-hmm. From whatever to 1 hertz, because I guess everybody, the employees, his wife, his kids, everyone was complaining.
Well,
so,
you get the idea.
Can't see that from
now. Yeah. So if it's nighttime, it's going to be
Pretty terrible.
These almost look round.
Jim's been shaking them a lot.
Yeah. Anyone got a coin? Quarter?
Yeah.
So we did this demonstration last night, and the salt we used, they're all little cubes.
Yeah, actually, there's one of the last ones you showed. The last one, because you have a nice cube in that.
This?
Yeah, you see on the. That's what I think. Think it further up. Right, that one. Is that one? See, so you made your cube in that?
Yeah, little it's bit. From a salt shaker, so they're probably ground down to the edges.
Probably.
We were doing margarita salt last night.
I bet some entomologists might like this.
Yeah.
Someone suggested to me that fly fishermen would buy this instrument.
It's actually a little, of course, you can make backgrounds. Mark. Can you see Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial?
Yeah, that's a real test.
So the coins, the tough thing is that they're so reflective that, you know, if they're not angled just right, all the light gets reflected away. Mm-hmm. You just did a couple more. That was pretty good. Sure. So you did a couple more there. So what we've got set up right now inside this is we have three cameras. The two outside cameras are 1.3 megapixel cameras, and the center camera is a 5 megapixel camera. On the two outside cameras, we have a 12 millimeter lens and a 16 millimeter lens. And on the center camera, we have a 35 millimeter lens, and the hope there is to be able to actually see drop formation? Is that
it? So I mean, they'll get 9 micrometer resolution on the snowflakes. But there's a very shallow depth of field.
Yeah, so it's very difficult to get stuff in focus, as you can see. That's this one here. So if you were to, you know, if that had been in focus, that would have been pretty cool.
What's the f-stop on that?
It's just slightly above 8.
Okay.
Yeah, but these are really rough. I mean, the gauges on those things are really rough. So yeah, I think we're back to where we started. But I don't know. Did you want to open up the?
False speed.
There's our false speeds. So you can see Tim dropped the coins from approximately the same height each time, and it gives pretty.
Let's try for anything is consistency. Do Galileo's experiments.
Anybody have anything cool they want to drop through? Otherwise, that concludes the demo. Okay, or any questions too?
Questions.
Questions about the instruments, like more engineering-related questions, please.
Well, what is your acquisition? How many particles do you sample? Like those points that Tim was showing on the graph, how many particles were each point representing, typically? I don't know.
Well, we can go up to 1 hertz, and we're probably going to up that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't usually hit a hertz, but we do sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So one particle per second?
Yeah, but that's usually it's much less than that.
Okay. And the reason for that is the resolution of the cameras is sufficient enough to actually max out the bandwidth of the FireWire 800 connection. So we're just, I mean, it's just limited by the technology there.
So how do you protect it from the elements? And you showed before photos when it was outside in at Mammoth from the military, and they just took the instrument as it is, but
it's
snows, is it not?
Yeah, it's it is water resistant. I wouldn't say waterproof. But
what are the connectors?
The connectors are waterproof military connectors, so they're rated for outdoor use. So, and then you of course the computer has to be either indoors or up at Mammoth they bought a specific computer enclosure, heated enclosure that's waterproof as well. So, and lots of silicone. Silicone's great. Messy but great. So, yeah.
If there are no more questions, then let's thank.
Is anybody?